From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. There's a chill in the early autumn air, and Americans are bracing, as usual, for flu season. But this year, there's a new strain on the public mind, avian influenza, bird flu. Infectious disease experts and public health officials are warning that if bird flu mutates for human-to-human transmission, millions could die. In the 100-plus instances already of the virus jumping from bird to human in Asia, the death rate is over 50%. A human outbreak may never come, but it could, we're warned, and quickly. American readiness is a big question mark. There is no proven vaccine. Therapeutic drugs are in woefully short supply. President Bush, at his Rose Garden press conference yesterday, says he wants the military ready to quarantine whole sections of the United States.
If we had an outbreak somewhere in the United States, do we not then quarantine that part of the country? And how do you then enforce a quarantine? One, one thing to shut down airplanes. It's another thing to prevent people from coming in to get exposed to the avian flu.
And that may be just the beginning. This hour On Point, getting real about the avian flu threat and the now sharp warnings of a pandemic that could kill millions. We begin in Indonesia with Tim Johnston, reporter for the BBC, who's been following the avian flu story out of its area of origin in Southeast Asia. He joins us from Jakarta. Tim, thanks for being with us. You have new reports of deaths from avian flu just in recent days there.
Indeed. Some of the health departments here are saying we now have a seventh victim. And slightly worrying, we've just got tests back actually today that show that there is a victim in a place called Lampung. That's on Sumatra Island. This is the first time that avian flu, a human fatality or a human case, has moved outside the central island of Java. That's where almost half the Indonesian population live. And this is a very worrying development. And there are teams from the Centers for Disease Control, the Atlanta-based organization, and various other bodies up there investigating it as we speak. But it is indeed an extremely worrying situation here.
China has been ground zero for avian flu, migrating birds over those densely populated areas with lots of dense agriculture. Vietnam has been right there as well. We're reading about maybe 150 deaths in total so far, a bird-to-human transmission, and a death rate of about 50% or more, which is scary. How has the Indonesian government, which is kind of in the first row beyond China and Vietnam, how has it responded to the half-dozen deaths so far?
Well, a lot of people have said the response has actually been inadequate, but there are so many unanswered questions about bird flu, about the transmission vectors, about where the reservoirs of these diseases are, where it sits when it's not infecting humans. It's very difficult to eradicate. Cambodia, Vietnam, Thailand have all pursued the line of culling birds. But Indonesia has decided not to. It's gone down the route of vaccinating birds. That's for a number of reasons, partially because the poultry rearing industries in other parts of Southeast Asia, in Vietnam, in Cambodia, in Thailand, are much more industrialized than here. Here they reckon that 70 to 80% of the chicken population, at least, is in backyards. Almost every poor family in Indonesia will have a few chickens running around. There are an important household resource. They provide eggs, meat. The government has moved towards this vaccination program, and it's worked quite well in the commercial side, where they've got decent biosecurity, where they're cleaning the cages, where they can monitor the population and the health of the population of the birds. But it's a problem. You have to vaccinate every 2 months, and it's very, very difficult to vaccinate against, you know, the chickens that are running around in people's backyards. They're in constant contact with wildfowl, with ducks, which have been implicated in as a transmission vector for this disease. Also pigs. There aren't actually many pigs in Indonesia because it's a predominantly Muslim country, mm-hmm. but there are enough for them to make a significant difference. So the Indonesians are trying to vaccinate, but there's been a sort of a lack of commitment to any sort of solid form of control. They say they can't cull because it's difficult to control these chickens and they don't have the money, but the vaccination has also been patchy. So there has been quite substantial criticism, I think, of Indonesia's attempts to control this outbreak.
Right. We hear of millions of agricultural birds, mainly chickens, killed in China and Vietnam, trying to get a handle on this. Among the dead, Indonesia had its first dead just this summer. Most recently, a 27-year-old woman, a 5-year-old girl. Last week, the health minister there, Siti Fadila Supari, warned of an epidemic. Other officials later played that down. What's your sense, Tim Johnston, of the candor with which the Indonesian government is likely to address bird flu with its own population and with the world?
Well, they are struggling with this. They're caught between the difficulty of informing the public of the dangers of bird flu and the necessity for good sanitation and cleanliness, and the fear of panicking people. They don't want to get people too worried about it and cause mass panic here. So they are sending, I think, mixed signals out, and that has confused everyone. It's confused health officials. It's confused the population. I think the part of the problem here is that it's unclear. They say that they've got some 85 suspected cases, or 85 potential cases. 69 of those are suspect, 11 of those are probable, and only 4 confirmed. Mm. Part of the problem is, of course, that the WHO, the World Health Organization, has a very strict criteria for defining what is a bird flu case and what isn't. And Indonesia is proving a little bit slow, I think, in sending samples up to the laboratory in Hong Kong, which has the best reputation for confirming or denying these cases. They are trying, I think, but they are, as you said, sending these very conflicted signals, and people are unsure as to what they should do. And there have been cases of people forcing their neighbors, for instance, to slaughter their chickens. The chicken sellers in markets in Jakarta particularly are having an extremely tough time, although there's no evidence that this disease can be spread by infected meat or eggs yet. But it has to also be said, of course, the transmission vectors in this case is very, very unclear. One of the fatalities, in fact, the first fatality here, has no known connection with poultry at all, yet he and his daughter were killed by this disease, or he and his two daughters, they believe, were killed by this disease. His wife and their eldest son was absolutely fine. Some people are saying there's a genetic predisposition, perhaps, to this disease. But it's very unclear, and the Indonesians are struggling at the moment.
And that tension between informing and panicking, well, it seems the whole world is wrestling with that right now. Tim Johnston in Jakarta, thank you very much for joining us. Tim Johnston, a reporter for the BBC, he joined us from the Indonesian capital of Jakarta. We're talking this hour about the avian flu threat. You can join the conversation. Did you hear the World Health Organization warning last week that avian flu could kill 150 million people? Does this sound hypothetical to you or like a real threat? And can you imagine a flu that kills half of those infected? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Nashville, Tennessee, is Dr. William Schaffner. He is chairman of the Department of Preventive Medicine in the Division of Infectious Diseases at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine. Dr. Schaffner, thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom. Very good to be with you.
So here we are. We're trying to get a handle on the scale of this threat, the immediacy of it, the potential impact. Yesterday, the president in the Rose Garden going on a long time about the seriousness of it and the seriousness with which the U.S. government is taking the threat. How serious is the threat of bird flu globally and to the United States right now, Dr. Schaffner, and are we prepared for it?
Well, it's serious and it is a threat. Now, it's like trying to anticipate a hurricane. We expect that one will come, but we don't know exactly when and how large it will be. You know, there have been 3 major influenza pandemics. A pandemic is an epidemic that involves the whole world
Yes.
in the 20th century, 1918, 1957, and 1968. And everyone who studies influenza viruses thinks that one will come eventually. And we're rather due for one.
Due for one, meaning that the planet has a natural cycle of taking on influenza pandemics among humans?
Well, let's look back at the 20th century. There were 3 major influenza pandemics, which means that the influenza virus mutated in an entirely new form, one that the human population hadn't seen before. And we all think that influenza virus will do that periodically. It doesn't come with the clockwork of a Swiss train, however. And so we don't know exactly when it will happen. So I think then the next question is, so why are we so worried about what's happening with bird flu in Southeast Asia?
Yes.
Well, two reasons. One is that these new influenza virus strains come from Asia, and they come from changes that occur in influenza viruses that affect birds and may also get into pigs, and then they spread around the world. So what's happening in Southeast Asia with this new avian influenza strain, which is spreading so widely, has our attention, and the potential is there for a mutation to take place such that the virus can suddenly be transmitted from person to person and then Katie bar the door.
A mutation sounds distant. Some of these estimates sound very close and real. People talking about hundreds of thousands or millions globally, 150 million. People saying, officials, well-placed officials, saying we are phenomenally unprepared. Bill Frist saying the amount of therapeutic drugs on hand is totally inadequate. Are we sitting ducks for this?
Well, the world's population would be theoretically a sitting duck if a genuinely new influenza strain appeared. This is a virus that spread very, very readily. The world's population would be susceptible, and you could become affected.
Become affected. It sounds kind of clinical, but we're reading here about really unhappy reality of what that might mean. We want to look very soberly and closely at exactly the nature of the threat and exactly the nature of U.S. preparedness. Dr. William Schaffner, if you'll please stand by, we have to take a short break. We're talking about the avian flu threat. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the threat of avian flu, bird flu, and the now sharp warnings of a pandemic that could kill millions. You can join the conversation. Did you hear the WHO warning last week that bird flu could kill 150 million globally? Are you confident the U.S. is prepared, or are we looking at the Katrina of medicine here? And if there's not enough treatment to go around, and there is not even close, who should get it? Who will get it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined by Dr. William Schaffner, chairman of the Department of Preventive Medicine in the Division of Infectious Diseases at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine. Dr. Schaffner, so it's already transferring from birds to humans. The big danger is if it goes from humans to humans. If that happens, we read that it could go from China to the United States in under a week, and that we could suddenly be having an outbreak here. What would that look like? Is this flu like other flus?
Well, it looks clinically like other flus, and yes, it could spread fairly rapidly from Southeast Asia to almost any part of the globe on airplanes, and we would see people developing fever and chills and feeling poorly and serious cough and being ill enough to be taken to their beds. And some of those people, influenza causes a spectrum of illness, but some of those people would be ill enough to need hospital care and supportive care in an intensive care unit with breathing machines and the like. And so the possibility exists that the clinical needs would soon substantially impact our health care capacity. There's no doubt about that.
Again, you speak in very calm and sober terms. I'm looking here at this is Erwin Redliner, the director of the National Center for Disaster Preparedness at Columbia, saying this is the next big catastrophe we can reasonably expect, and the country is phenomenally not prepared for this. He talks about cities looking like science fiction movie sets, hospitals absolutely overwhelmed, morgues overwhelmed, the country just swamped with the sick and dying. Is that hyperbole, or is that what we're looking at here potentially?
That's the worst-case scenario. That certainly happened in 1918. It did not happen in 1957 nor in 1968, so we don't know exactly how severe it would be. Worst-case scenario, I'm afraid that vivid picture is likely to be correct. But all hurricanes are not force 5 or force 8,
mm-hmm.
and so it remains to be seen. But as to the issue of preparedness, we do have a long way to go.
Lori Garrett wrote at length in from the Council on Foreign Relations, wrote at length about this. She says that right now, in the 150 or so cases so far, it's killing 55% of the people it infects. She calls it the most lethal flu we know of that has ever been on the planet, affecting human beings, and that, of course, since it hasn't been here before, nobody has an immunity to it. Now, it's 55% death rate when it comes from birds to humans. If it mutates human to human, would that death rate likely go up, down, stay the same?
Well, the general experience is, and we can step back a little bit, is that once we start to examine the entire spectrum of infections, we discover other milder forms in the infection that are not going detected. You always discover the most seriously ill variant of an illness first.
Okay.
So it's more likely than not that we will see a spectrum of disease, and the mortality rate of 50% will diminish as we get more experience with the disease, which I hope we don't get.
And what are the chances of it coming? I mean, it's interesting. The country is now, Washington clearly, in a tizzy about this, yet the threat has been out there for a while. Is it a growing threat? Does it grow with time?
Actually, this threat probably is growing. We have not seen this widespread bird influenza of a specific type in Southeast Asia for some time, and we've also noted that because the virus affects waterfowl in western China, they have a migratory flyway that can get them into eastern Europe. So the extent of the spread of this particular kind of virus is unprecedented, and that's what has all of us influenzaologists very nervous, because the more widespread it is, the greater the chance for a mutation or for this virus to join with a human virus and do a little viral sex and exchange genetic material and pick up the capacity to be spread from person to person.
Is the country prepared or reasonably prepared? We read Irvin Redlener saying it's phenomenally unprepared. What's your assessment?
Well, as Secretary Leavitt said, better prepared than a year and a half ago, but not sufficiently prepared yet. And that's true. We have been waiting, for example, for a national influenza preparedness plan to be released so that all the 50 state health departments can key on that and make more nuanced their own preparedness plans. But we haven't seen the final draft of the federal plan yet, and it contains some very, very important elements, such as who's going to pay for the vaccine that we produce and when will it be distributed and by whom. Those are very critical elements.
Dr. Schaffner, if you'll stand by, I want to welcome into our conversation from Richmond, Virginia, Dr. Diane Woolard. She is director of the Division of Surveillance and Investigation for the Virginia Department of Public Health, Virginia's putting together its own pandemic influenza response plan. Diane Woolard, thank you very much for being with us.
Good morning.
Good morning. So here we are looking at these numbers nationally. All kinds of numbers are out there globally and nationally, hundreds of thousands, millions. What are you anticipating or expecting or preparing for in Virginia?
We have done some estimates of what we would expect to see, and we are trying to prepare for 1 million outpatient visits due to influenza within a 12-week period and up to 30,000 hospitalizations. So it would be an increased demand for medical care services, as Dr. Schaffner said.
Is that a medium outbreak, a mild outbreak, a serious outbreak?
Well, that's looking at 25 to 35% of the people getting sick from the disease.
And what's the normal flu season incidence of flu?
Oh, I'm not exactly sure.
Dr. Schaffner, is it a higher number here, 25 to 30%?
It's usually not that high. It's less. It's 1 to 10%, and 10% would be very high.
And what about a death rate? Do you have something that you're using as a rule of thumb, as a planning benchmark, Dr. Woolard?
Yeah, we have calculated the expected deaths. It's around 5,000, I believe.
So that would be a rate of what percent deaths among those infected?
We are looking at maybe about 5% mortality rate.
So far beneath what we're looking at now out of Southeast Asia, which is 50
yeah.
or 55%.
Yeah, it could be more, and we realize that we would have to have plans for what how to handle the excess bodies, because there will be an excess in death. We're quite concerned about all the features that Dr. Schaffner raised.
What about that? What about hospital capacity and morgue capacity? Is it nearly enough, or will they be swamped?
I think they would be swamped. We are working with our hospital partners. All the hospitals in Virginia, and I'm sure other states, are working to increase their surge capacity and developing plans for when there is excess demand. But I think that I'm glad that these conversations are occurring, because I do believe that demand for services will exceed capacity, and it's something people have to be aware of. It's not anything that we can do about right now, other than just realize there may be times when someone you love or yourself needs a hospital bed and can't have it because all the beds are full, or that if you're in the hospital, you may need to be discharged earlier to free the bed up for a more severely ill patient. There are certainly a lot of hugely challenging features of planning for this sort of event.
Dr. Schaffner, the demand and capacity issues are gigantic here, and I'd like to look at those for a moment. Around vaccine, which doesn't even exist yet, I guess, around therapeutic medicine, and then finally just around hospital space. Maybe first on this front of therapeutic drugs, there's Tamiflu, which can be used, it's presumed, I guess, to treat even bird flu when and if it arrives. As I understand, there's only about 2 million doses of that in the United States, a country of approaching 300 million. Am I right?
Well, almost. There are two anti-influenza drugs. Tamiflu is the one that's used most frequently. There's another, Relenza. There are, in the U.S. stockpile, about 2 million doses of Tamiflu, but there's much more that's available just generally from year to year. And
what do you mean by that? Available to the United States or to the world?
Well, to physicians who need to prescribe it tomorrow, because there's much Tamiflu that's in hospitals and in pharmacies now ready to be used in this upcoming influenza season, where it would probably be the most popular anti-influenza drug that's used.
Can you put a number on that? 2 million sounds so far short of the nation's population, or the 25% or 30% infection rate that Dr. Woolard's talking about. How many doses do you think there are nationally?
I'm not sure about that, but there are 2 million in the national stockpile, and there are plans to buy more. I think it is true that proportionate to our population, we have at the moment stockpiled less than many of our other developed nations around the world.
We read Secretary Leavitt saying he'd like to have 20 million doses on hand, but that Roche Laboratories, which produces Tamiflu, has organized this on a first-come, first-served basis globally, and the United States is way down the list, that we didn't put our hand up first.
That's probably correct, and Roche is increasing its manufacturing capacity very, very substantially. They can't keep it on the shelf. It's moving out all around the world.
So if this should come, what's your sense, Dr. Schaffner or Dr. Woolard, of how it will be determined who gets the therapeutic drugs?
Those discussions are ongoing in our Tennessee Department of Health within Vanderbilt, where we have a disaster preparedness plan that we have drilled many times, just as Dr. Woolard has said, and I'm sure it's going on in Virginia. And the national discussions are availing themselves of medical ethical experts to help us think clearly the prioritization scheme.
Dr. Woolard, how are you looking at that? We hear Bill Frist saying we've got a woefully short supply, and it's the first thing he's going to reach for, the doctor in the Senate, when or if avian flu arrives in Virginia. If you only have enough for a fraction of your citizens, who's going to get it and who's not?
Yeah, this is a hugely challenging thing to determine. How are you going to prioritize segments of your population? And as Dr. Schaffner said, we have an advisory committee we formed where we're getting input from ethicists as well as other groups on their opinions of it, state police and the pharmacists and business people. And right now we haven't determined that, and we are hoping to see some more specific guidance when the federal plan comes out. But in the absence of the federal plan, we are continuing discussions of that and trying to determine what we would decide in Virginia.
I mean, is it a big checkbook? Is it status in the government or society? Is it vulnerability, physical vulnerability?
Those are the things that we're debating, and I think that we have to determine that. I've heard it seems pretty consistent that people think healthcare workers, or at least certain healthcare workers, should get top priority because we need them to be well and healthy to take care of the very ill people. So that may be different from what we usually see in a normal flu year in terms of who we recommend to get the vaccine first. So the question really is about Tamiflu and vaccine and not just Tamiflu alone. But the same kinds of questions would be, if the pandemic occurs, we don't have vaccine manufactured yet. It could take months before vaccine is available. And then when it comes out, there wouldn't be enough for everyone. So we have to make the same sorts of decisions. Who should receive vaccination first? It may be healthcare workers. It may be people who maintain order in society, such as police. It may be pharmacists, so they can fill the orders for the medicines that people need. It may be the chronically ill who normally are at greatest risk of complications for flu. So those debates are ongoing, and we don't have it determined yet because it is extremely difficult to make that sort of ethical determination at this point.
I'm Tom Ashbrook.
We haven't been faced with having to do that in a long, long time, if ever.
And maybe soon, and one can only imagine the ethical issues and the rush, the scramble, if this should come, because, of course, there won't be ever forever to respond to it. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let me take a caller here. Mark is calling from Amherst, New York. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Basically, I just wanted to mention that I had been in Hong Kong when one of the first bird flu scares came out in the late 90s. And then, unfortunately for myself, I ended up in mainland China when the first SARS outbreak occurred. In fact, I ended up going back to China during the SARS event on business. And it's interesting, when I was listening to the one doctor talking about the migratory patterns of birds, one of the things is the migratory patterns of business people going back and forth to China, Vietnam, many of these places.
Sure, lots of them.
On a daily basis. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's literally with direct flights now going from those Asian countries right to Chicago, right to Minneapolis, right to Toronto.
And yet, Mark, it has not mutated and turned into human-to-human transmission. So when you hear this flurry in the last week, does it sound like overkill to you, like panic, or like an appropriate mustering of attention and resources going on?
Well, in mainland China right now, they're taking a lot of strategies to actually prevent something like SARS again from happening. And I can tell you firsthand experience, just in the last several years, they have upped their standards for basically responding to these events. When we were going through the airports right after the SARS event, and even at business conventions, people were being closely screened with very, very high technology medical devices and heat devices to see if people had SARS, and they were kindly pulling people aside that may or may not be affected.
That is a comforting report. On the other hand, you know, birds fly where they will, and it's hard to imagine everybody necessarily being screened. The symptoms don't show up right away. I guess they're carried for a while before they show up. Mark, thanks for your call. Dr. Woolard, what about quarantine? President Bush talked about it yesterday and using the U.S. military to do it. Can you see that as an effective response to bird flu?
Maybe early on, in when there are just a few cases that are occurring in different parts of the world, we want to work as quickly as we can to identify any person who may have the disease and get them into isolation and identify their contacts and quarantine them in case they are developing the disease, in order to do whatever we can to try to slow the spread of the disease across the globe. If it occurs in a village, it sounded like he was talking about quarantining the village, and that sort of method has been used in the past to control the spread of disease. It's not clear how well it would work for influenza because it is easy to spread, and I think we would need more information and more debate and more details about the plan for that.
Dr. Schaffner, we just got half a minute before the break, but your sense of a military cordon or quarantine against bird flu?
I share Dr. Woolard's caution. With a disease that spread as readily as influenza is, I think it is unlikely to work. We could use the military to help us with logistics and planning and distribution of materials and keeping people in line for influenza vaccine and the like. and they could be very helpful in that regard. But military cordon sanitaire, I don't think so.
You don't see it. Dr. Diane Woolard at the Virginia Department of Health, we're grateful to you for being with us this hour. Thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Listeners, we're talking about the avian flu threat. You can join us. President Bush says call out the military and use quarantine. Does that make sense? If there's not enough treatment to go around, not even close, who should get it? Who will get it? And this, what's the appropriate fear factor here? The appropriate factor. 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the avian flu threat, bird flu, and American readiness for a pandemic that could, not necessarily, maybe not at all, but we are being warned, even by the president, could be extremely serious, could kill millions. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Given all we've heard, what are you going to do? 1-800-423-8255. Talk. We've been joined this hour from Nashville by Dr. William Schaffner at the Vanderbilt University School of Medicine, and we're joined right now from Rochester, New York, by Dr. John Traynor, professor at the University of Rochester Medical School. He is testing a new vaccine to combat the avian flu virus. Dr. Traynor, thank you for joining us.
Hi.
How close are we to a vaccine that would work?
Well, I think we have a very good idea of what it would take to make a vaccine that would probably prevent at least the severe manifestations of a bird flu infection. What we're wrestling with now is how we would actually supply such a vaccine in sufficient quantities to vaccinate everybody that needs to be vaccinated, and whether there are ways to increase the supply through strategies to use lower doses.
So first of all, just the creation of the vaccine, are you saying we've got it or we're close to it, we're within weeks or months or years?
Well, I think we know the pathway. NIH has contracted with the manufacturers that make regular flu vaccines for the U.S. to make pilot lots of potential pandemic vaccines for H5 and actually some of the other avian viruses as well. And we've gone through the process with one of these vaccines of actually testing it in humans and verifying that it's safe and that it does induce antibodies that would probably protect against the bird flu.
So a vaccine has to be rolled out before the flu arrives, presumably. Is there any plan to roll anything to begin vaccinating for bird flu this year before this flu season?
This has been discussed, but I actually do not know if that is a current plan. It is one option, and that certainly has generated a lot of discussion.
Once a person gets vaccinated, how long would it take before it becomes effective, the vaccine, the immunity?
It looks like for bird flu, it would require two doses of a vaccine, and so you'd be talking about a probably 35 to 42-day period of time before you would really have the antibodies that we're trying to generate.
So that's a lot of time and vulnerability once you've got the shot, but then there's the issue of how many vaccine doses we can come up with, how quickly. We've got a country of almost 300 million. What portion of Americans could be vaccinated within the first, let's say, I don't know, months, 6 months?
Well, that's a very difficult question to answer because it depends a lot on a couple of things that you'd have to decide, one of which would be whether the vaccine would actually be made and stockpiled ahead of time or whether you'd just start making the vaccine when you thought a pandemic was imminent. And it depends on what ultimately is the dose that's required and how much of the vaccine at that dose manufacturers are able to produce.
You've talked about a worst-case scenario, worst case in which 200 million people could die. So what does that mean for your work, for the urgency that ought to be behind this drive to get the vaccine created and out to the public?
Well, I think this is clearly a very urgent situation in terms of preparation. Now, it was not my estimate of 200 million deaths, although I'm sure that that is a scenario that's at least in the realm of possibility. But clearly, this is a real public health threat, and we need to move with all deliberate speed to be prepared, or as prepared as we can be.
I want to begin turning to our callers again, if I may. Cliff is calling from Foxborough, Massachusetts. Hi, Cliff. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
What do you think, Cliff?
Well, I'm not a medical professional of any kind, but I have read a lot of the articles that have been circulating on this issue, including the one in Foreign Affairs a little while ago.
And Lori Garrett's piece, yeah.
Frankly, I think this is really a pretty clear case to me of the boy crying wolf. It seems to me that every time a Vietnamese or Cambodian chicken farmer gets a cold, the worldwide medical community goes into a panic that it's the avian flu. The scrutiny with which these communities are under in terms of family members of the same family becoming ill, I just think it's unrealistic to think that it could spread that widely, that quickly. If you look at what happened with the SARS thing, if I remember correctly, a few hundred people died in the entire world, and there was all kinds of quarantine restrictions that were put in place almost immediately. I've heard this number of 150 million, possibly 200 million dead,
right,
many, many times, but I haven't heard anything at all about how was that number arrived at? I don't think the medical community does itself any service by blowing off the potential bad effects of something like this about a disease that, frankly, doesn't even exist yet.
Cliff, we've got it. We got your perspective very clearly, and I want to put it to my guests, if I may. William Schaffner, is the medical community crying wolf here, or is there the capacity to, even if this does emerge, to get a handle on it quickly, to box it off and restrain the threat, the damage?
Well, Tom, Cliff's skepticism, I think, is to a degree warranted. I don't think you'll hear my friend John Traynor and I use those worst-case scenarios. There's a spectrum of illness that could occur. There isn't any doubt that if we have a new bird influenza virus that can go from human to human, we're going to see a lot of disease and a lot of illness and a lot of deaths in the U.S. as well as the world's population. So we are well advised to be as prepared as we can be, just as John says. And part of that is the development of vaccines, which both John and I are involved in.
John Traynor, our caller says he doesn't believe in this explosive transmission that people are warning of. You've looked closely at this virus. Can you picture explosive transmission? If it begins to go human to human, is there any avoiding explosive transmission?
Well, I think one of the things that Cliff needs to remember is that we've had pandemics of influenza before, and we understand that when they do develop, they can spread very quickly. The most recent really big pandemic was in 1957. It was a sort of medium-sized pandemic,
mm-hmm.
and it spread worldwide over the course of about 4 or 5 months, traveling from the Far East to involve the entire world. The projections of deaths in the current pandemic are based on the experiences in previous pandemics. If we had another pandemic like 1957, and we simply extrapolate the numbers of deaths in the U.S. that occurred then mm-hmm. to our current population, we'd be looking at something around 200,000 to 250,000 deaths in the United States.
And if it was on the scale of the Spanish flu earlier in the century?
Well, I think that's exactly where these extrapolations come from. I think the number of deaths in the Spanish flu, not completely known, but estimated to be about 20 million deaths worldwide and about 600,000 deaths in the United States. And if you extrapolate the population of the world in 1918 to what it is now, I think that's where these numbers of 200 million deaths come from. And, they're not outside of the realm of possibility.
But I can imagine people thinking in response to that observation, well, but we're much more sophisticated in medical science today than a century ago. Is that the right way to look at it, John Traynor? We're less vulnerable because science has advanced, medicine has advanced.
No, I think ironically, we're not actually that much less vulnerable. The supportive care that we have now that we didn't have in 1918, in a massive epidemic like that, would probably not be available because it would be simply overwhelmed. As Mike Osterholm has pointed out, we only have enough respirators or machines for artificial ventilation to basically handle the people that are already on them. There's very little excess capacity in the U.S. healthcare system, and I think a problem with a pandemic would be that our ability to provide supportive care would be very limited.
This is Mike Osterholm, the director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy, who has recently quoted saying, "We will run out of caskets, literally, within days." Andres is calling from Washington, D.C. Andres, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, hello.
Hi.
I'm going to be coming at it from a kind of a different perspective. My fiancé and I are going to be traveling in that part of the world in May 2006.
Where exactly?
Well, we're still fleshing it out, but Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam, possibly China.
Okay.
And sort of we're looking for, you know, we're going to be staying in hostels, so I guess we'll be sort of high risk, and we're looking for what we can do to protect ourselves, and also wondering if we're going to have a hard time getting back into the country on the way back.
Or whether you'll be quarantined there by the U.S. military, as George Bush
exactly.
might describe it. Andres, let us look at that. William Schaffner, what about it? Andres is going to be traveling around sort of ground zero there, but whether you're in Asia or in the United States, if it turns into human-to-human transmission, what steps can people take to minimize their risk?
Well, Andres and his friends are going to have a very good time, and they'll be able to get back into the United States. I don't anticipate that we're going to be having a big pandemic whilst he's traveling. But the sorts of things that we will be doing are, as we've said before, vaccinating. We'll be treating some people with antiviral agents. And most important, we will be restraining our activities. We'll be washing our hands. We will be circumspect about how much crowd activity we'll be engaged in. I think there is no doubt that travel will be curtailed. And all of those sorts of things, the stay-at-home and hunker-down approach will curtail economic activity in the United States and around the world.
That's both a comforting and a kind of hair-raising answer. At the same time, John Traynor, William Schaffner points to, reducing our exposure. Looking back here at the Spanish flu period and others, people just stayed home. They stayed home for a long time. They went into kind of self-quarantine. Can you picture Americans doing that again?
Yeah, probably. I think, first of all, in terms of the current situation in Southeast Asia, the only real recommendation would be that probably you would not want to travel to poultry farms, and you would want to avoid live bird markets or situations where you are being intensively exposed to potentially sick birds.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, there really would be nothing at the moment that you'd have to be concerned about in traveling that area, and I'm sure it'll be a fantastic vacation trip or business trip, whichever it is.
You're both so reassuring. But if it comes, let's say, to the States, and you're going to have tens of millions at least, maybe hundreds of millions of people who do not quite possibly have access to the vaccine or the therapeutic drugs. What do you say to them, John Traynor? How can people up there, you know, we're looking at these, worst case again, nasty survival odds, not the kind you like to see. How can people help themselves?
Well, I think one of the things we probably would do would be to decrease situations where large numbers of people are gathered together that might be facilitating transmission. So I suspect, although I'm not involved in this planning process, that some of the early maneuvers would be to close schools, to stop having large events like professional sporting events and things where people are gathered in large numbers, and probably to restrict travel to a certain extent.
For how long?
Well, I'm assuming that this would probably go on until the first wave of the pandemic had occurred and we were ready to start intervening with vaccines.
Is that days or weeks or months?
I suspect it would be several months, but this, again, is not really my area of expertise.
That's an incredible picture, though, clamped down on travel, on school, on sporting events for months. Susan's calling from Alexandria, Virginia. Hi, Susan. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I basically have no confidence in the CDC in being able to handle this situation. They failed us so badly with anthrax and with recent flu vaccines. I have a feeling that they they're so insular at this point that they're not consulting, for example, animal husbandry people and veterinarians with regard to some of these types of situations which these folks deal with on a day-to-day basis. And I'm also listening to some of the doctors talk here and also the public health people about who would get vaccines. People don't stay home. They send their children to school sick, and they spread the flu vaccine, the regular flu, sorry, the disease itself, all over the place. We keep inoculating people in nursing homes, but where are these people getting the flu since they're in there?
People do go to school, but if people start dying in right. significant numbers, that might right. change behavior, huh?
Well, you know, I mean, the parents want to go to work. They go to work sick. They send their children to school sick. And having been a teacher for 30 years, I can testify to that. But here's a nail in the coffin for you.
Ouch.
You've got a large group of the population in the United States, and all over the world for that matter, becoming more and more allergic. Dr. Trainor's talking about a new vaccine. Dr. Trainor, I have to ask you, all the current vaccines are egg-based, and most of them chicken egg. Anybody who is allergic to eggs can't take any of the current flu vaccines. What are you using to do this?
So that might be one sector in trouble, even with a new vaccine. Dr. Trainor, what do you say to Susan's question?
Well, actually, Susan has raised a very important issue, which is the role of children in the spread of influenza during even regular flu seasons. And actually, this has been recognized for some time, and we are seriously considering changing the way that we use vaccines in the U.S. to increase an emphasis in vaccinating school children for the very reasons that Susan mentioned, that this might have a major impact on transmission, and in fact, that might also be true in a pandemic scenario. The vaccines that we're testing are made in eggs because they're designed intentionally to be as close in terms of the way that they're made to the regular flu vaccine as possible. And in fact, if someone were severely allergic to eggs, they would not be able to be vaccinated. Now, we know that the frequency of severe egg allergy in the general population is quite low, far less than 0.1%. So although this would be a problem for some people, we suspect it would be a very small number compared to the numbers who could be protected.
A problem, but it sounds like it might be the least of our problems at that point, though acute for the people who had it. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Dr. Schaffner, what about the fundamental question that Susan raises about preparedness? President Bush trying to be reassuring yesterday, and Secretary Leavitt as well at the same time, clearly holds still here. What grade do you give the U.S. government at this moment for its preparedness around the issue of bird flu?
B-, I think. We need to do more, and I think the recent discussions are akin to hitting the mule over the head with a 2x4 to get its attention. I think maybe our colleagues in Congress are now getting the message. All of our preparedness is costly. It's going to cost money, and there will be a reluctance to spend the substantial sums of money to get ourselves better prepared against an eventual possibility. And so We're kind of stuck there. These discussions, I think, will move the likelihood of more committed resources to preparedness along that line.
And John Trainor, we just have half a minute. William Schaffner says we're due for a pandemic. How do you see the odds of us being faced with bird flu in the United States? 50-50? Greater than that?
Well, if you think that the chances that a rare event are going to occur because it hasn't happened in a long time, my advice is to go to Las Vegas and try some of the slot machines. You just can't predict. You know, we have these things happening in Southeast Asia, and there's just that possibility because no one knows what the likelihood is.
And if it comes, as we hear today, the consequences could be absolutely staggering. Dr. John Trainor at the Rochester Medical School, University of Rochester, thank you very much for being with us this hour. Good luck with your vaccine work there.
Thanks a lot.
And Dr. William Schaffner at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine, we thank you very much for your good guide work through the thicket here. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Schaffner.
Good to be with you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.